Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math, see how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network. Today on the James Altucher Show.
I mean, you started doing stand-up when you were 15 and you dropped out of high school, and then really the next thing we hear from you is that you're on Saturday Night Live and you become a part of the cast there. What's happening between 1970 and 1980? Like, how did you kind of build your skills?
God, I don't know. First time I went up on a stage, I was 15. And I think everybody in show business has this. It's that split personality where one half of you is like, I'm going into show business and people are going to pay money to come see me and they're going to go to the movies and turn on the TV just to watch me because I'm that great. And then the other half of you is saying, oh, please love me. Please love me. I want some reassurance that I'm worth it.
Do you think you need both? Because when you're on the stage, you probably can't let the audience see you're nervous about what they think, or else they'll tear you apart. But at the same time, you have to perform material that you know is going to make them laugh.
Yeah. So it's a definitely split thing.
Was there ever a point where you felt like, oh, I did go too far?
I remember I once did this show that was a tribute to Joan Rivers. I went on stage, and it was right after there was that shooting at this gay nightclub. And I started doing jokes about the shooting at the gay nightclub. And the audience was laughing all the way through. And you know, Joan Rivers, that's a largely gay audience. And one guy tweeted me and he said, I never thought I'd wake up crying and go to sleep laughing. And one other guy sent me a tweet. He said, You make me laugh at times when I don't want to, and that's when I need it the most.
Tell me when you start rolling, though.
Let's start.
You know, it's interesting because you have this almost above and beyond persona on stage, and I feel it gives permission to comedians to say, well, I can at least do something with my voice, or I can at least say all these curse words, or I can at least, you know, hit this very sensitive material, because Gilbert Gottfried does it, and he's Iago on Aladdin, so it must be okay.
So basically, I'm ruining other people's careers.
No, I think it makes it better, because you widen the scope of what they think is acceptable in today's day and age.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about this on the podcast, right, though. Okay. Oh, we're recording?
Yeah.
Okay, well, okay. I've got Gilbert Gottfried on the podcast. Gilbert's been in everything. I feel like for the past...
Schindler's List. I was third Jew to the left.
Yeah. Schindler's List.
Yeah.
Saving Private Ryan. Every
yes.
World War II movie.
Yeah.
Every Platoon with Oliver Stone. And then on top of that, Beverly Hills Cop 2.
Yeah.
A bunch
Apocalypse
of Eddie Murphy
now.
Movies. Yeah. I would say... if people say, oh, I loved you in X, I think it's probably first Iago, the bird on Aladdin. But
yeah.
Also, your voice is so distinct. You're the Aflac duck.
We have to say was.
Was.
Yes.
For 11 years, though. That's a long time for a commercial gig. What else? I mean, you've been on everything. You've been on every late night show. You've been on, if you go down your list of credits, you've been in 100 movies, 50 TV shows. When people say, hey, I loved you in X, what do they usually say?
That varies. And that's which is a good thing. Sometimes they'll pick like kids, family entertainment like Aladdin or that I do this voice on a cartoon called Cyber Chase. And, children stuff like that. And other times they'll say the Aristocrats.
Yeah, but also your image of you with your voice and your squinting, like that image itself is like iconic. Like you're in the popular culture for that particular look and voice. Where do you think everybody, is it Beverly Hills Cop 2? Is it, I don't know.
A lot of times people come up to me and they can, recite the whole Beverly Hills Cop 2 scene. And that was fun because we just started improvising.
Oh, really?
Me and Eddie. It was a basically short scene, and it wasn't that funny. And we just started, each time we did it differently and just had fun with it.
And Eddie Murphy, who many people consider the greatest comedian ever, I've seen him call you the greatest comedian ever. Like, you obviously had a great relationship with him.
Yeah, they're like Sammy and Dean.
How did you guys meet?
The first time I met him was, he was on Saturday Night Live. Originally, they hired him as a featured player, and then later on, they made him a regular. That was a terrible season of Saturday Night Live.
Well, that was the first season where the whole original cast was now gone.
Yeah.
And you're in their place.
Yeah, it was kind of like if...
1980.
If you change the entire cast of Friends when that show was on the air and just brought a bunch of new people in and you go... Wait a minute. Who's playing Joey? Who's playing Rachel? I don't like these.
You
people.
Would be David Schwimmer, the David Schwimmer character. So, but I heard you say that's a great analogy. I heard you say that on Howard Stern. You did a great interview with Howard Stern about this period of time. You were on very few sketches. They didn't really use the full you. But I think you were still developing your voice and your character.
Yeah, it was a bad time to be there. And I remember when Eddie Murphy was still a featured player, they did some sketch called like a a nature show. It was supposed, and it was in search of the Black Republican. And they hired a Black actor to be in that skate. They had Eddie Murphy there, and they reduced him to just being a waiter walking around carrying a tray.
Was he upset? Like, this is after his some of his major specials, right?
No. By then, he wasn't known. But,
oh, okay.
But he was there, you figure.
Why'd they do that?
Yeah, I don't know. Very peculiar.
Was Lorne Michaels still running?
No. That was the other part of it. It was not just the cast that left, but Lorne Michaels left. So it was hard. It was like, you know, also if it, in the middle of Beatlemania, four other guys took over for the Beatles. You know, it's like you don't want to see.
Right.
And you don't want to be the replacement. You want to be the replacement for the replacement.
Right, because then that wave of replacements on SNL, they went all on to be movie stars, and people said, oh, okay, SNL can survive this.
Yes. Cause, but back then, it was like how, it was sacrilege.
Yeah.
Now it's like, when was the last time you knew the names of the cast members on Saturday Night Live?
I think back in the 70s.
Yeah. It's like now.
John Belushi, Chevy Chase, Eddie Murphy.
Oh, from the original? Yeah. But now it's like the cast changes like in between commercial breaks.
Yeah.
There, you know.
So there's so many things I want to get to. First, I want to mention there's a great documentary about you on Hulu called Gilbert. It's one of the most beautiful documentaries I've seen. Of course, you've had a career in stand-up since 1970. You're doing stand-up comedy almost 50 years now. When you were 15 years old, you started. You didn't finish high school. You also have a great podcast. I want to mention that. The Gilbert Gottfried Colossal Podcast. Amazing Colossal Podcast. And many, it's weird when I look down your list of guests, many of the guests have been on this podcast, like we just had on Henry, you had them on years earlier though. We had on Henry Winkler, Brian Koppelman, Paul Schaefer, bunch of guys that you've had on. But what's great about the energy of your podcast, and you do it on a very regular basis. Like I'm surprised you keep so busy with it, but you get your friends together in a room, it seems, and you just talk about what you love talking about and your inspirations and old movies you like and old comedians you liked. And it's a wonderful podcast to listen to, so I encourage everyone to listen to that.
And it's fun because I originally, when we were putting the podcast together, I thought, well, I'm interested in old Hollywood, but nobody's going to care. They're not going to know who these people are. And sure enough, it's like what I love is that people will go. I will get these messages where they say, I had no idea who that was you were talking about and who you were talking to, but I've been looking it up. And I thought they love these people now.
But I you know, it's interesting that you love old Hollywood. Like, I feel like your style as a comedian is almost like, let's say, a Groucho Marx, but if Groucho Marx was in 2018.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's a persona. And it's an extreme persona, the voice, the your face, even the way you're grabbing the microphone, you slouch a little bit, and it's everything's an extreme, and your voice has that you know, your comedy voice has that grating aspect. But then you tell these extraordinarily filthy jokes. And I remember the first time I heard The Aristocrats, and we'll get into this. It was right after 9/11 in 2001. You were at a performance on September 29th, just 18 days later.
The Hugh Hefner roast.
Yeah, the Hugh Hefner roast. And you tell a 9/11 joke, and the audience is like starts to groan, someone says too soon. And so you figured, tell me if I'm wrong, you figured, okay, I'm just going to go for it.
Yeah.
And you make up on the fly the filthiest possible joke. And I almost don't want to laugh at it because it's so extraordinarily, like, and I appreciate any kind of humor, but it's so extraordinarily crude. And I'm just like spitting out my food laughing the first time I heard it. Like, What happened that night?
Yeah, it was right after September 11th, like a few days. And it's like there were still black clouds all over Manhattan floating around from the, you know, it was still burning, the World Trade Center. And I they were originally going to cancel the roast because they figured, oh, how can we do a comedy thing now? And then it was like a lot of people didn't go. A lot of people were afraid to go on a plane, certainly. And so I was up there and I figured I wanted to be the first person to address the elephant in the room. And so the first time I started slowly and I said, tonight I'll be using my Muslim name, Hassan bin Laid. And then I went into the other one, the one where I completely lost the crowd. I said, I have to leave early tonight. I have to fly to L.A. Unfortunately, I couldn't get a direct flight. We have to make a stop at the Empire State Building. And people were booing and hissing and chairs were screeching back. And one guy yelled too soon, which I thought meant I didn't take a long enough pause between the setup and punchline.
You assumed the audience was professional comedians?
Yes. And then I figured I was... If you said I was up there for 200 years after that joke, I'd believe it. That's what it felt like.
Well, you gripped the podium and you kind of stood back and you were squinting. It's almost like you were figuring out what to do. Like, what was going through your mind right then?
Yeah, I didn't know. It's like you're kind of floating through space. Because I'd lost an audience as much as anyone could have.
And in a very high-stakes situation.
Yeah. And then I go into the aristocrats joke, which is an old joke, but everyone does it a different way. And I figured, you know, I've already lost the crowd. Why not go to the bottom level of hell? And then they started laughing and applauding and cheering. And it just showed that they needed that release.
Yeah.
And it's like, someone wrote an article where they said it was like I had performed a mass tracheotomy on the crowd.
Yeah, because the laughing, you could hear it, was nonstop, and I was laughing. And then you did something else interesting there, which is mid-joke, you've described already all of these pornographic situations among this family, you know, very kind of almost middle American family, and you describe situation after situation after situation, more and more disgusting. Yeah. And then you start pointing at the audience, you know, do you need me to start from the beginning?
Yeah.
Because you have to catch everything in order to understand this joke. And just that commentary on the joke was ridiculous. Like, so you're improvising as well. Like, and I feel like I've seen you do that a couple of times where when a joke is almost getting too much and you want to back up a little, You comment on the joke, mid-joke, to kind of give people a breath of air before you continue. Is that planned? Like, you know you're doing that?
Yeah, no. I mean, it'll just pop up in my head at times like that.
And you'll say, do you want me to repeat that for you? I mean, I've seen this in multiple jokes. Do you want me to go further? Or you'll repeat the same line to make sure they understood. And you'll point at one person just to kind of get them... And you get the audience riled up because now they know you're going to point at them. They're on call.
Oh yeah. Yeah, no, that was just happening to me on stage when that was.
And so this is after, I mean, you started doing stand-up when you were 15, and I'm just reading this out of your Wikipedia page, and you dropped out of high school, and then really the next thing we hear from you is that you're on, you know, people see you and you're brought onto Saturday Night Live and you become... part of the cast there. What's happening between 1970 and 1980? Like, how did you kind of, you know, build your skills?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I started, it may have even been 69. I mean, first time I went up on a stage, I was 15. And I was doing mainly impressions because I used to watch old movies on TV and stuff and imitate the actors I'd see in them. And it wasn't really far from when they used to have mimics, when they used to have like impressionists. Now in Vegas, you'll find impressionists. And on like SNL, I'll have people who can do impression, but the old style of like, you know, Frank Ocean, Rich Little, George Kirby.
Rich Little, yeah. His entire career was impressions.
Yeah. Their whole thing. And, two people we've had on the podcast. We had on Rich Little and Will Jordan. And Will Jordan's the one who invented the Ed Sullivan imitation. But yeah, my act was pretty much like that. Like, you know, hey, imagine if your waiter was Humphrey Bogart, and it might go something like this. And, you know, and then...
Yeah, you did a classic Jackie Gleason in Casablanca.
Oh, yes.
As Humphrey Bogart, everything's so funny.
And then as it was going on for years, I was going up whenever I could on stage, wherever they'd let me go on. And then after a while, I just sort of got tired of just the impressions and started playing around when I was on stage. And then I started to develop more of a real act.
What does playing around mean, and what does develop a real act mean?
Well,
you're still very young at this point.
Yeah. I was playing around. And back then I would just go up on stage with nothing prepared and just start talking and joking around. Sometimes I would lose. It was weird. It was like I'd lose the audience totally sometimes. They'd be walking out. And I remember I didn't mind it all that much.
I think that was an advancement in skill, not minding what the audience thought of you?
Yeah.
Because probably at first, when you were 15... maybe you were scared to death of what the audience thought.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, it's still to this day, I have that thing though, where it's like, and I think everybody in show business has this, it's that split personality where one half of you is like, I'm going into show business and people are going to pay money to come see me. And they're going to go to the movies and turn on the TV just to watch me because I'm that great. And then the other half of you is saying, oh, please love me. Please love me. I want some reassurance that I'm worth it.
Do you think you need both? Because when you're on the stage, you probably can't let the audience see you're nervous about what they think or else they'll tear you apart. But at the same time, you have to perform material that you know is going to make them laugh.
Yeah. So it's a definitely split thing. And to this day, there are shows I'll do where I won't bomb, but I'll know it's not, you know, like wasn't great. Like the audience might be laughing and applauding, but I'll know. I just don't feel it was strong enough. And I'll go off and say, well, I've been getting away with it so far, and now they're catching on. I think a lot of people feel that, like one day the jig is up. I always feel like show business is a party that I snuck into. And one day they're going to walk over to me with a clipboard and go, oh, I'm sorry, your name's not on the guest list.
You know, and I, what you're saying to me sounds ridiculous, but I won't try to correct you. But I mean, the obvious thing is you've created such a large persona and you've been involved in so many activities and so many people consider you an inspiration to their own comedic skills. Like at some point, one would think, oh, I've passed that line. I'm a success. People know I'm a success. But you're right. Look at like how many people, you know, one thing happens and then their career is over.
Yeah. And it's like, How many times does a movie pop up on TV where you'll see an actor or actress and you'll go, God, they used to be in everything back then. And now I don't even remember what their name is. I have to look it up. And it's like, you know, like overnight, they're forgotten about.
Yeah. So like, you know, actually I had this conversation the other day. Like, do you remember the TV show Arliss that was on HBO?
Oh, yeah.
Robert Wall?
Yeah.
Whatever happened to Robert Wall?
Yeah. Well, he was on our podcast.
Yeah, so what did he do between Arliss and now?
Yeah, I don't know. It's very weird.
Like, did he make enough money from an HBO show that ran two seasons?
Yeah, I have no idea. I guess he's, who knows?
And so,
ask him.
But I do feel like one thing that's different between your act and a lot of modern comedians I see is that everything, every body movement, everything you do with your face, with your hands, with your back, with your legs, with your voice, the jokes themselves is all part of the act. And a lot of modern comedians and a lot of comedians beforehand too, I'm not just specifying these comedians, they'll just go up on the stage and they'll tell jokes and they have a good stand-up comedy effect so they are able to project and work with the crowd and control the crowd a little bit. But you, from the beginning, there's this absurdity. Like, who is this guy? He can't hold the mic properly. He's slouched over. He can't see his voice. What's that voice? You're giving people, what it seems to me what's happening is you're giving a lot of people excuses to laugh. You're giving a lot of people opportunities to laugh rather than just the joke itself.
Yeah. I think it's that, well, there's that old expression. I forget who said it. I think it gets accredited to just about everybody. And that's that the difference between a comic and a comedian is a comic says funny things, a comedian says things funny.
That's interesting. So like when you're just hanging out talking with your friends, lots of people are comics. They say funny things, their friends laugh. But a comedian, what's the difference? What's a structured way to make an audience of strangers laugh? Like when you're thinking of creating an act, what are you thinking about?
Boy, I never consciously thought of it. It's like when people say, where did your delivery come from? And I think to me, I was just performing so long, so many times. And then one day you wake up and go, this is my delivery. And that I've been doing for this many years. And to me, it's kind of like walking up to somebody on the street and saying, hey, you know, when you walk down the street, I noticed the way you move your arms when you walk. Where did that come from? And it's like, it didn't. They didn't consciously think of it.
Right. So like with your voice, for instance, you must have over time, because I know how your voice sounds normally. You must have over time developed that as part of your act and saw, oh, people consistently laugh even before I start telling jokes. And so it becomes an easy way to get the audience to know who you are, to get the audience to like you, and then easy to slip into the jokes. And the jokes could be crazy because the voice is crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's more thought than I've put into.
Like you're able to do the Aristocrats. I think if you were just talking in like my voice, people would think, who's this? Like if I were to do the Aristocrats the way you did it that one time, or many of your jokes, people would say, who's this creepy guy? They might be correct. And they might say the same thing about you. But with you, they're allowed to say it because your voice advertises it right away. Yeah, you're going to get something a little bit creepy and a little bit disturbing.
So I guess so. And now, like I said, it's more thought than I've ever given.
Well, I really like to analyze everything that's happening. And then, you know, you've said something that I think is very interesting, which is that if somebody tells you not to joke about something,
oh yeah,
you're definitely joking about it.
Yeah, it's because it's one of the, well, it's like, you know, if you're in school and they tell you to be quiet, you'll want to make noise. And I've always felt like in funerals, like the sometimes you'll see people sitting there and one person will lean over to the other with a smirk on their face and say something, and the other person will throw their hands over their mouth not to laugh.
Right, because there's so much tension.
Yeah.
And laughter is almost this way of kind of breaking through the tension.
Yeah. And it's like it's needed, but it's like it's looked upon as, oh, no, that's horrible.
Well, here, but this is an interesting question, and it comes up a lot lately, that when is something too soon or inappropriate? Is there a line? Like, you always want to go, and you've mentioned this, you want to go to the, you want to figure out where the line is and go right over it. And yeah. I think you were quoting George Carlin. But can you go too far over it?
It, I don't know. I mean, too soon always was interesting to me because, number one, who is in an office with the computer and the chart and going, okay, it will be okay to joke about this on exactly this date, like, and then it'll be okay. And I feel like, you know, like me, when they say too soon, and that makes me a bad guy. And if you wait and it's not too soon, then you're the good guy and you're more sensitive to it. And to me, it's like when I do a joke about something that's happening right then and there, right when it's happening, it's like you're part of what's so funny about it is that you're going, oh God, how awful taste. This is such a sad and horrible thing that he's joking about. So it acknowledges that it's sad and horrible. When you do a joke later on, like you could go up and do an hour and a half on the Titanic sinking. And nobody will get offended. And it's like, and that'll make you a good person because you're saying, hey, fuck all the people who died on the Titanic. That was years ago. And that's what a good person.
Right. So your point is that if you're commenting on it while it's still in the immediate public zeitgeist, A, you're bringing attention to it so that people are aware of the situation, but also You're cutting through the tension for all the people who don't know how to process. You're making them laugh for all the people who don't know how to process what's going on. Like when the Japanese tsunami happened, you made a series of tweets about it that were mostly extremely funny. And it's not like everybody in America was crying simultaneously until you made your tweets. Then they're like, oh my God, Gilbert Gottfried is not going to, his career is not going to survive 10 tweets that he made.
Yeah.
You know, like what, were you surprised at the reaction? And by the way, this was so big a reaction that Aflac dropped you as the voice of Aflac, who knew 75% of their business was in Japan.
Yeah.
I would not have guessed that.
Yeah. No, I found that out soon enough. It was like, And it was like, yeah, it was, well, to me, I've always been doing jokes like that. And I thought, to me, it was like, if every morning you get up and eat a bowl of cornflakes, and then one day you eat a bowl of cornflakes and all hell breaks loose. And that's what I felt like. And it was like, I loved when people were saying stuff like, oh, and Gilbert, you know, a top story tonight, Gilbert Gottfried's career is over. And I'm thinking, what I've realized was, if your career is over, you're not their top story. You know, if you're—
That's kind of a good point.
Yeah. If your career is over, you could run into a burning building and save a baby, and they're not going to report about it because you're not important a name for them. And so I realized that, and you realize that as long as they spell your name right, because it was weird. It was like, especially with the internet makes me feel sentimental for old-time lynch mobs, because at least with the old-time lynch mobs, they actually had to put their boots on, go out and get their hands dirty.
They had to kill you.
Yeah, they had to go out and actually kill you.
Now all these anonymous people could just say, shame.
Yeah, yeah, you sit on
the... It's a witch hunt.
Yeah, you sit on the couch in your underwear and form your own little lynch mob. It's kind of like the space age way of ringing someone's doorbell and running away.
Yeah, and but, you know, the way you're describing it now, like... Oh, they said Gilbert Gottfried's career is over is the top story. So that must mean I still have a career. This is putting a very good face on it. But when a million people are tweeting about you and Aflac is not returning your calls, and that was like probably a multi-million dollar ad campaign, did you cry? did you think it was all over?
It was, trust me. I thought... Well, I had a nice little run there in show business.
For 40 years?
Yeah. And now it's gone. And because it was like I was kind of, there were reporters parked outside my house for I don't know how long. And I would like finally.
Over a tweet.
Yeah. I'd leave the house and they'd rush out from doorways and from cars and everything like they had captured like the biggest serial killer. And I do remember, and it's in the documentary, they have a clip of a newscaster. They're showing the tsunami film clips of it. And the newscaster is saying, and to make matters worse, Gilbert Gottfried sent out a series of tweets. And I'm thinking, that made matters worse.
Right.
Yeah.
I remember that clip. It's like 100 cars are being swept away in this wave. And then somehow your tweet made matters worse.
Yeah.
So of course that's ridiculous. But at the same point, what was the societal anger underneath that? Like, why did that happen?
I have to say, Airbnb has changed my life. I just love staying in Airbnbs. Like in about a month, I'm going to Cocoa Beach, which is right next to Cape Canaveral. I'm going to watch some rocket launches. I'm going to, of course, be staying in a very nice Airbnb on the beach. And it's just such a great experience. Like the whole world is available to us now because of Airbnb. But whenever I'm at an Airbnb, I always realize, you know, the home that I left to come to this Airbnb, I could be making money on that right now by hosting and being an Airbnb myself. So, and I've known people, I had a friend who basically, you know, made a living from turning his home into an Airbnb. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, you do have an Airbnb there. And it can easily fit into your lifestyle, and it's a great way to earn some money. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. The famous Abraham Lincoln quote says, good things come to those who wait. I wonder, did he really say that? Jay, did he really say that? Can you look that up? Regardless of who said it, that's only part of the quote. The full quote is, good things come to those who wait, but only the things left by those who hustle. Well, if you're a business owner and want the best people on your team, the same applies. And listen, I've interviewed 1,500 people now and a lot of entrepreneurs. I can safely say the one thing consistent among all entrepreneurs and CEOs, the successful ones, is that it's all about the people you surround yourself. If you hire well, you're going to have a great business. And, you know, thankfully, ZipRecruiter puts the hustle in your hiring. So you find qualified candidates fast. This is so important. And I want you to try it. You could try it as a potential employer or employee. You could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter's smart technology finds top talent for your roles right away. Immediately after you post your job, if you're hiring, ZipRecruiter's matching technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I will tell you that I signed up on ZipRecruiter as a potential employee. You know, I just wanted to see how it works. And right away, it started matching me with really amazing potential employers. So give it a try at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Let ZipRecruiter give you the hiring hustle you need. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/James to try it for free. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Who doesn't love a classic chocolate chip cookie? Famous Amos has been making them since the 70s, 1975 to be exact. With semi-sweet chocolate chips and a satisfying crunch, it's everything classic in one bite-sized cookie. And fans couldn't get enough. That's right. You'll find our original recipe, the one you know and love, in every bag of Famous Amos original chocolate chip cookies. Find Famous Amos anywhere you buy your favorite snacks.
It's now with the internet. I mean, I remember growing up, there were certain newscasters, columnists, commentators, and authors who you'd listen to. You knew they were educated and intelligent and knew they what they were talking about. Now everybody is that.
But it's not, that trend is never going to reverse.
Yeah.
Like, it only continues.
Yeah. Yeah. Now everybody can put a show on the internet. Everybody can be a commentator. Everyone can do anything they want.
And some people, I guess, you know, I feel like there are teams. And so if you kind of join the right team, you can get everybody on that team.
Yes.
To go behind you and say, yes, Gilbert Gottfried was awful for doing this. And like one of the tweets, I thought it sort of reminds, like, you're clearly aware of how sad the situation is, even if you say something funny about it. Like, you know, you'll say it obviously better than me, but do the tweet with the girlfriend.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I said, I just split up I forget how that joke even
I think goes. My girlfriend just broke up with me.
Yeah. But like a Japanese guy told me, there'll be another one floating by in 5 minutes.
Right, which is on the one hand funny. It's got a setup,
yeah.
Punchline. It's funny, and it's you could really only tell that joke right then.
Yes,
and at the same time, you're obviously aware of the sadness.
Well,
the situation.
It always got me when people say to me, like, aren't you? How could you joke about that? Aren't you aware of the sadness and the tragedy? And I always go, well, yeah, I am aware of the sadness and the tragedy, and that's where the joke comes from.
Right, you're breaking. So let's actually work through the process of that particular tweet. The tsunami just happened. People died. You look at what's the highest stakes thing that could happen to a person? Oh, they could lose their family, or they could lose their wife, or
yeah,
kids, or girlfriend. Kids might be too much. Like, oh, my kid died.
Yeah.
Don't worry, another kid will be flowing. But that might,
yeah,
be too much. That might not be funny, because it's little kids might not be as funny. But a girlfriend, yeah, is, you know, plays up on, you know, people break up with girlfriends,
yeah,
all the time. And it's sad and it's tragic. But what would be happening in Japan and the same thing? And you kind of mix the two.
Yeah.
And I guess come with a joke. I'm just trying to imagine what your process was.
Yeah. And once again, not that complicated a process. I just thought, whatever joke, like I said, I asked my Japanese real estate agent, is there a school in the neighborhood? And she said, no, but there will be in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's like stuff like that. And it's, yeah, it was a definite strange time period.
Yeah, and so then for yourself personally, like you were 56 or 57 years old, did you think, oh no, am I going to be bagging groceries at Whole Foods? Like, what's going to happen to me,
yeah,
next?
Oh, definitely, because, you know, like I said, you're always walking around thinking, you know, when is the jig up? You know, when are they going to find out? And I thought, oh, this might be it.
But could you have thought to yourself, well, at least I'll go back on the road and I'll make a few bucks this way, or like, or I don't know, like what was going through your head? What was the scariest thought going through your head? Do you think about killing yourself? Yeah. Like, what was going on?
A million things were going through my head. I remember, I stopped answering the phone for a long time because I thought it's going to be someone who wants to interview me. The horrible Gilbert Gottfried about, and you know, they all have their own agenda. You can't explain.
But you can't do interviews at that point.
Yeah, because, and there's a lot of interviews you do. If they have an angle on it, then it's hopeless.
Right. Even if they say something is ridiculous and you say to them, please tell me you know that's ridiculous, and they say that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
They're still going to get their angle and ignore you completely.
I would have people, interviewers, say to me right before we went on the air saying, oh, I thought all those jokes were hysterical. And then they go on and they take the moral approach.
Yeah. And then would you ever call them and say, I thought you were on my side. I thought you were going to say something different.
It's pretty much hopeless.
So it's sad and it's anger that's coming up.
Yeah.
But deep down, what's the worst moment? Like, where were you emotionally at the worst moment during this?
Oh, God, I don't remember. I just remember thinking, oh, this is it.
But what does it mean, this is it? Does this mean...
Like it's all going to stop here.
But what would stop? Your comedy career?
Yeah.
Would your financial life stop? You'd have to be an accountant somewhere?
All of that. Yeah, all of that. My showbiz career would stop.
Like, what did you think in your head? Oh, this is what I'm going to have to do now to make money next year.
Yeah.
What did you think?
I don't know. It was all gone. And it was like, the funny thing is I didn't realize at the time that, you know, the villain of the month is like, you know, just like it's the flavor of the month at Baskin Robbins. They also have the villain of the month, sometimes the villain of the week on the internet.
Yeah.
We need someone to go, hey, come on, gang, let's get a posse together and go after this one.
Right, it's this team effect. Like, you know, if one person on a team of a million people say, okay, now we're going to aim at this guy, they all come down on you.
And I think also it's that thing of like, when people get offended and outraged, they're patting themselves on the back. It's like, see, I was outraged.
Yeah, you're right. It's like a way of having... Like, so here you are, you've worked for 40 years at building a craft that's incredibly difficult. You've been on a ton of movies, you've entertained 100 million people, and for once, some anonymous guy in their basement could have status over you.
Yeah, and I remember I got two tweets I remember the best. One tweet was really funny, this guy wrote, Affleck fires Gilbert Gottfried after discovering he's a comedian. And I thought, that's really hitting the nail on the head. And one other guy sent me a tweet. He said, you make me laugh at times when I don't want to, and that's when I need it the most.
Yeah, and see, that's why. So I'm still thinking about the construction of the girlfriend joke. So we've dealt with the too soon argument. What would be too much? If you had replaced girlfriend with your kids, would that have been too much? Or would it have been not funny?
It's weird because I find myself, you know, being hypocritical all the time. My favorite thing is when Mel Gibson was getting in all that trouble.
Right. So and, just to mention, you're obviously Jewish.
Yeah.
And Mel Gibson was pulled over and he was... did a 0.12 on the alcohol level, which was, he was way drunk, and he starts screaming how all the fucking Jews are taking over the world.
Yes, he screamed the Jews.
And then he apologized the next day.
Yes, are the cause of every war. And he called the policewoman sugar tits. And then news came out that when his wife was holding their baby, he was slapping his wife. And he said he'd like to get a bunch of black guys, only he didn't refer to them as black guys, and to rape and kill her. and he'd smash her over the head with a shovel and bury her in the rose garden. And after all that, after I heard all of that, all I could think was, well, wait a minute. What did he say about the Jews? And that was really it.
Right. And well, actually, all that other stuff you just said, I didn't even remember. I only remember the thing about the Jews.
Yeah.
So we were on Team Jew being really horrified at Mel Gibson. And yet his career, you're right. He was a villain for about a year. And then, I don't know, he's probably broke box office records since then.
Yeah, it's something. It's always, yeah.
And they blame it a lot on like his brain chemistry really changes when he's under alcohol. So you have to forgive the alcohol Mel Gibson versus the sober Mel Gibson. But who knows? But the question is, so Mel Gibson's not a comedian and nothing he says is going to be told in a comedic way. For you, again, we dealt with the too soon issue. What would too much be? When would you say, hey, this is a tragic event. If I were to say it in this way, it's probably too much for an audience.
I've never really thought that. And I guess I've been lucky. I've never really thought that.
Because you're always, your brain's trained to think what's over the edge.
Yes. Yeah. It was like, I just would keep, it's like to me, if you look up on the internet, and on just day-to-day life, you've heard a million dead baby jokes. That's a whole category of jokes. Right. You know, how do you make a dead baby float? A glass of ice cream and two scoops of dead babies, stuff like that. And with those
By
jokes,
the way, I don't get the joke, but just the way you say it makes me laugh.
Yeah. And it's like there's a million dead baby jokes, and it's like, you know, when you do those jokes, you're not really saying that, oh, I approve of a baby dying. It's like when you're doing those jokes, you know it's horrible. That's why you're saying the jokes, because it's so awful. And it's like, you know, you're not saying, gee, I approve a baby's dying.
Okay, but let's say, take the recent example with Roseanne Barr. And I don't like to date a top podcast the way I'm doing right now, but the Roseanne Barr incident happened in the past month. Usually I won't talk about things happening right now so the podcast could last forever. But take the Roseanne Barr incident where she, you know, says all these things about Valerie Jarrett. Is her sin being too much? Is her sin being not funny? Where, or both? Or like, what happened there?
Yeah, that was another one. It's a funny thing, though. Like, when I hear about someone else getting in trouble, I kind of enjoy it now because I go, oh, see, everyone will be talking about that person.
Right, but
me. There,
but yours was a case where I don't think you did anything. Not that I'm the arbiter, but clearly I think the time has shown you did nothing wrong and you know, again, it sounds like I'm judging the situation, but Roseanne Barr, I wonder 10 years from now, are people going to say, oh, that was no big, it's like Kramer when he, you know, flipped out at the Laugh Factory in LA, he probably went over some line that's societal. And I mean, he did go over some line. His career hasn't come back.
And it is funny with him. It was like that thing of everyone ignores that he was being filmed on people's phones, and no one ever said, hey, you know, you're not supposed to take your phone into a comedy club and start filming people.
Right.
And that's the first thing that struck me. And I thought, had this happened before the age of cell phones and before the age of the internet, it would have been something that comics would have laughed at and talked about for a few weeks or months afterwards, laughing about what happened and then forgotten.
Well, you know, it's like Dave Chappelle commented on it. He said, A, that's when he started forcing people to lock up their phones, and it only gets unlocked when they leave the show. And the other thing he said was, you know, he said the black person inside him was horrified, but the comedian inside of him, and he says, I'm like 80% comedian. The comedian said inside of him said, man, Kramer's having a bad set.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And that's all it is. It's you're having a bad set.
And yet his career never came back. So whereas yours, you know, obviously did, you know. So there must be some line where it really is too much, even for someone who's supposed to be saying ridiculous, absurd things.
And I remember with that, with the Kramer, Michael Richards, then there was like the manager of some club announced that from now on, anybody who says that word on stage, the N word, that also makes me laugh. The N word, the F word, the C word. Like when you say those expressions, you're saying those words aloud in your head. So why can't you say the word?
Right, and Louis C.K. even comments on that, and says it.
Yeah.
You know, in an act, and no one holds it against him. I think with Michael Richards, the problem was he wasn't saying it as part of an act. He was yelling it at someone he was angry at who was leaving the audience.
And it was, so this guy announced that there'll be a fine given to any comedians who says that. And I thought, wouldn't it have been better for that club owner to go, hey, I might not agree with that. He might say offensive and awful things, but I'm not stopping anybody. And if you come to my club, you might be shocked and offended by people you see. And that would be like, you know, because when he says he's going to forbid that word, it's kind of like if you advertise that an amusement park, our roller coaster goes very slow and it doesn't rise up too high. There are no sudden moves. It's all very safe and very slow. You don't want that. You want to feel like you're going to die.
Well, and it seems like your process, and I hate using that word almost, it makes it sound like you go through some scientific formula when you sit down, but you're figuring out, okay, where's the edge? Where is it too soon or too tense? And you're going to figure out some area on the other side of that line. And sometimes it's okay. Sometimes you might miss the mark. That's what happens when you're experimenting and trying things. So was there ever a point where you felt like, oh, I did go too far? That and as a result, nobody laughed. I mean, maybe the 9/11 situation.
Oh, yeah. There's all those things. I remember I once did this show that was a tribute to Joan Rivers. And I went on stage, and it was right after there was that shooting at this gay nightclub. And I started doing jokes about the shooting at the gay nightclub. And the audience was laughing all the way through. And you know, Joan Rivers, that's a largely gay audience. And one guy tweeted me, and he said, I never thought that I'd wake up. He goes, I never thought I'd wake up crying and go to sleep laughing.
That's good. Well, also, it reminds me of your roast of George Takei.
Oh.
All you're doing is gay jokes, and they were extreme.
Oh, yes.
And the audience was cracking up. Everybody around you was cracking up. George Takei is cracking up. So it seems like it's hard, particularly when you're in a humor situation, as opposed to Michael Richards, as opposed to Roseanne Barr, who's trying to make a political comment funny.
Yeah.
She wasn't really in a humor performance. When you're in a humor performance, really everything should go. I mean, everything should be fine, but people don't consider it that way. It's sort of like, even like Daniel Tosh, the rape joke, it didn't happen during his performance. It happened while an audience member was leaving. So he was angry.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like they're allowed to, people get status over him when he's slightly outside of his performance.
And I think George Carlin said, if I remember it correctly, he said, anyone who thinks rape jokes aren't funny, just imagine Daffy Duck raping Elmer Fudd.
That's good, but even the word rape people don't like to see. Because rape could mean many things. It could mean you're being taken advantage of in some horrible, sadistic way. But even if you use that word, it's now owned by, and I'm not bringing up rape specifically, but like many words now feel owned by different demographics.
And you show me one comedy that takes place in prison where you're not doing 5,000 rape jokes.
Right.
It's like almost by law, you have to fill it with rape jokes. But if it's a guy being raped, it's like, oh, that's fine. There's no problem there. And it's like, well, if you're going to say rape isn't funny, then you should get equally offended by prison rape jokes.
Right, but priest abuse jokes, people often don't think, you know, they either think are too soon or too much, you know, even from comedians. So it seems like there's some areas where it's like, you got to be very careful. You're touching like a hot radiator.
Yeah.
And again, your job as the comedian is to go over that edge. So you're it's like you're wearing a spacesuit and you got to make sure you don't get too far from the spaceship or you'll float away.
It's kind of like, I forget his female name now, Bruce Jenner.
Oh, Caitlyn Jenner.
Caitlyn Jenner. It seems like by law, you have to say he's the most beautiful woman in the world. And, or she, I don't know. Yeah, also, that's something that will get you
them.
In trouble.
Yeah.
Should you say he? Should you say she? Should you say they? And you're also supposed to refer to him as a hero. And I'm thinking, well, is he? I don't know. It's like, I mean, I know like the firemen who ran into the World Trade Center, I know are heroes.
Well, let me just tell you, Gilbert, if you chopped your penis off, I would consider you a hero.
Yeah.
So when you were dealing with the Aflac and the tsunami, what was the first step back out of the darkness? Like when you thought all was over, how long did it take? Like, what was your support system like? Like, what did you need to essentially not just lose yourself in depression at that point?
It was gradual. I mean, it was like, because the depression was definitely there. The fear was definitely there.
What were you afraid of? Like, other than the career, which is important, were you afraid of money? Were you afraid
nobody
would like you?
Yeah, all of the above. And I remember one thing that struck me. I was watching TV and they had, actually on the internet, and all over the internet was Chris Brown was backstage at the Today Show and he got angry and flung a chair across the room. And that was covered the internet. That was the biggest news item. And I'm going, this week, Chris Brown throwing a chair is bigger than the tsunami was.
And then after that, was there an actual difference? Like, did you start performing again? Or like, when did you first leave your house for something professional after the Aflac?
I was pretty immediate, And then I would do jokes about the whole thing because you had to,
right.
It's like, once again, the elephant in the room.
And it sounds like you had a good support system. Like obviously your wife, Dara, must have been very supportive. Like, don't worry, you'll come back. Howard Stern was supportive. He had you on.
And I remember at some, they one time asked Joan Rivers about it. And she was like, oh, that's so stupid. That's what he's supposed to do. And I thought, and I loved how when that was happening, they wouldn't say I said jokes. They would all say comments and remarks. Because if you say jokes, you're going to go, well, isn't that, it's a joke. What are we getting up in arms about a joke?
I guess you can argue, like, let's say you said the same thing, and here we are, we're sitting on the stage of a club called Stand Up New York. I guess if you said it here, it's clear it's a joke. On Twitter, nobody knows anything.
Oh, yeah.
So they could say, oh, it's whatever I want it,
yes,
to be. I can label it with whatever I want. It's a celebrity saying a comment.
Yeah, and it's like so many things like, oh, one of the other Jenners was in a commercial, a soda commercial. And it was supposed to, in the commercial, there's a protest going on, and she hands everyone a bottle of this soda, and it calms down the protest. And people were up in arms about this, how tasteless this was. And I thought, wait a minute. It's a stupid commercial, but how many commercials are known for their vast intelligence?
It's almost arbitrary, particularly in today's polarized age. It's like us versus them, depending on, you know, it doesn't matter who's the us and who's the them. It's always us versus them. It seems like everybody takes a position and then someone's under attack.
Yes.
And it's arbitrary.
Yeah.
Like people picked on your tweets out of 7 billion tweets made that day. They picked on your 10 tweets.
Yeah, like, and it's kind of like, you know, all those expressions, like they say, that came from advertising. Like, let's run it up the flagpole and see who salutes it. Or let's...
Well, what ad was that from?
I think they said that's from that expression came from advertising, because you'll try something out, and if it catches on, then you keep doing it. Or let's throw it against the wall and see if it sticks. And so you see that with the news a lot. They'll catch on to some story, and they'll see if it's got any life to it. And if people get up in arms, they'll keep doing it. And if people don't get up in arms, then it's like, okay, find something else.
So in today's day and age, Donald Trump's president, it's almost too easy to, like, you don't see a lot of comedians just making fun of Trump because it seems like almost cliche to do that.
Yeah.
Like, if you were to make an act today, what would be some of the issues you would look at? Like, okay, this is very tense. Potentially there's a line here and I'm going to go over it. What would be some of the things you would look at?
Oh, God, I don't even know. I mean, political stuff I never really did.
Yeah.
And then
I guess keeps it fresh because you could do the same joke 10 years later, 20 years later.
Yes. And it's like most political jokes seem to me like, if you're the host of a late night talk show, you could do those jokes because you do it that night, and it's still fresh.
Right.
And by tomorrow, it won't be.
Right.
It's like, I heard they're going to bring back Murphy Brown, and I...
in about a week.
Yeah, and I... Murphy Brown was one of those shows I never quite got, because, like, they do a joke about Dan Quayle or something like, and I go... Maybe when this was first reported, you could do that. Like if you're the host of The Tonight Show, you could go on that night. And it's kind of funny because you just heard it. And then after that, it's like, I feel like, what does that joke mean? Let me look it up.
Right. Well, you did... I feel like with Louis C.K., he sort of started the trend of comics rewriting their act every single year, starting from scratch. You didn't really do that. You kept a lot of jokes throughout the years. But, I listen to your podcast. You're cracking jokes all the time. You're a funny guy. So, and again, maybe it's the difference between you being a comic versus being your comedian persona. But if you were to say, okay, I'm going to make a new act and go on the road... would you sit down? Would you just look around and start observing things? Like, what would you do? And I know I'm asking questions that might not have answers.
That one definitely doesn't have. Because, where most of my act came from was going up on stage and something would hit me and I'd start fooling around with it. And then if it worked, I would start expanding on its own. I was never one of those people that got up in the morning, had a cup of coffee, and started typing out 10,000 jokes that they.
But you might write notes. Like I saw in the documentary, you have notes. Like there was a Sig Heel joke. There was you had celebrity fucking joke, or I don't know what it was.
I had that, yeah. But and always like I write down those notes, and then I can't even understand 99% of them.
And but I guess though maybe after a decade or so experience of dealing with crowds, you would start to get a feel, okay, this direction is working, this direction is not working, and then you would expand on the direction that's working, and that would build up your act.
Yeah, it has happened that way, yeah. I'll just, would just, something would get to me, and it just would start expanding on its own.
And what's, like, why do you do the podcast? Like, it seems like you're really a super hard working. You do more podcasts than me, I think.
Yeah.
Like I do this all the time. It seems like you're releasing a couple episodes a week sometimes.
Yeah, it's funny. It's like a lot of times when I'll get a guest, it'll be like people I would have liked to have spoken to anyway, but at least this gives me a reason to. Like Dick Van Dyke was on, he was
hilarious.
Great. And Bruce Stern. You know, to just sit and talk with Bruce Stern about stuff and all those people.
And like a lot of times you're talking about your old inspirations. What are some of the new comedians and comics you look at? Because you had a great conversation with Howard Stern where you talk about how so many people say they're inspired by, so many young comedians now say they're inspired by Richard Pryor or Lenny Bruce. And it's almost ridiculous because even though they were funny during those days, a lot of their comedy is dated. Even the style is dated. Like, what modern comedians now do you sort of take a look at and say, oh, that guy's pretty good, or that woman's good?
It's funny. It's like you could have been raised, you could have gone into show business because you used to watch Hee Haw on TV. But if someone asks you, you'll go, oh, well, what influenced me was Lenny Bruce, Richard Pryor, and George Carlin. That's what influenced. And it's like, I always feel like if you say to any one of those people, like, well, can you tell me one of their bits or one of their jokes in particular? And they won't know. They'll just know those are the names. It's just like there are names of people you're supposed to hate. Like Gallagher is one of those, you're supposed to say, oh, he's no good.
Right.
Or,
Carrot Top,
another one. Like, oh, we hate him and it's okay. It's just like, I don't know who Anne Hathaway killed in her career. I don't know what murder spree she was on that it's perfectly okay to hate Anne Hathaway. I mean, I never got that one. But there are these people. There are other people you have to knee-jerk reaction, say you like or say you hate.
But is there anybody that you would say, or maybe you don't watch, like, I don't know, the latest? I mean, Netflix has so many. I think they had like 70 specials last year. It's hard to keep track of them all.
Well, that's the thing. When people ask me, like, what comics I like, it's like, that's the problem. It's kind of like, to me, watching comedy is like going to work on your day off. And it's like if you are the manager of a restaurant, when you go to another restaurant, you're sitting there the whole time going, oh, see, I would have done that differently. I would have done this and this. And it's like, so when you're a comic and you watch another comedian, you find yourself going, yeah, that's clever. Yeah, that's funny. Yeah. And it's like you're not really laughing, but you're, you know, mentally going,
You know, it's, you know, and then this will start to round it up. I think we have a few minutes left. But again, I think your style is to be absurdist in almost every way, as I mentioned before. Even the jokes themselves are absurdist. And take someone like Louis C.K., he often had an absurdist bent, but then he started opening up and talking a lot about his personal life. And that really kind of moved his career in a different direction. Do you ever feel like, oh, maybe I should, you know, now obviously you're, I don't want to say you're set in your ways, but you know what you want to do when you're on the road and stuff. Do you ever feel like going into the personal life or making fun of your kids?
It's weird because, you know, with the documentary, Gilbert on Hulu, that was the first time I really out and out revealed myself. And they hit upon it in the film because I always think of that scene in Wizard of Oz of, hey, don't look at that man behind the curtain. And so it's funny. That movie got so many, nothing but great reviews.
I think because it shows the contrast between this odd persona you have on stage and the real you.
Yeah.
And it's a very big contrast.
Yeah. And it was something, it's like, yeah, I all the reviews have been great. People always come up to me saying they loved the documentary. And to me, I was miserable making it and I'm miserable watching it. Because it's almost like the first time you hear your voice recorded and you go, well, there's something wrong with that machine because every other voice they recorded correctly, but not mine.
You know, it's funny because I think that documentary was so great because it mixed your comedy with this real persona. But you're 63. You've been doing comedy since you were 14 or 15, and nothing else. And it almost seems in that documentary, and I haven't seen anyone mention it this way about the documentary, it almost seems like you're this big or older child just having a lot of fun. And even though it has its ups and downs, there's sad moments in the documentary and there's very touching moments, but there's this childlike aspect that I think most people don't have, which I think is what I really got out of the documentary. Like, I'd like to live my life that way. It is inspirational that way.
Yeah, it's like mentally and emotionally, it just kind of stopped somewhere.
Do you think that's true, that you're like just this big child? Like, it's almost like it's great you have your wife and kids around.
Yeah.
They kind of order the world around you for you.
Yeah, it's like, it's funny. I always laughed and rolled my eyes when I'd hear Jerry Lewis in an interview say this, but then it started to make sense to me. He would go, well, with me, I'm nine. And I thought, and then after a while, at first I thought that's so pretentious and so, but then I thought, no, I get that totally.
And I maybe also keeping that childlike way allows you to constantly view the world in this absurdist fashion. Like you're able to hit the limit in almost as absurd ways constantly. And like the biggest example to me is the Aristocrats joke, but there's many, many examples. And I don't know, it seems like that absurdity could often be funnier than, people always say, oh, find your real voice, find your truth.
Yeah.
But maybe life is absurd to you.
Yeah, it is.
Well, Gilbert Gottfried, you're an inspiration to me, a hero to me, and a great comedian. I do think your comedy is timeless and should be studied by anyone wanting to be a comedian or an artist. And I don't even know what you want to promote. Everybody should listen to your podcast, the Gilbert Gottfried
Amazing Colossal Podcast.
Yeah, great podcast. And I just love the chemistry between you and your friends.
Yeah.
Talking your inspirations. Everyone should do a podcast like that, but they should listen to yours for inspiration.
And Gilbert is the documentary. And oh, my website, GilbertGottfried.com.
GilbertGottfried.com. And when are you going to do a Netflix special? I feel like if I were your agent, I would just call Netflix and say, give this guy $500,000 to do a Netflix special.
If I had a brain in my head, I would.
You have a brain in your head. Yeah. Why does your agent do this? Who's your agent? We're calling your agent.
That's what I'd like to find out.
I'm calling Netflix.
Yeah.
after this and getting you a Netflix special.
Yeah.
I won't even take a cut. You could just have one. So,
oh, thank you.
Thanks once again for coming on the podcast, and you're always welcome back. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
That was fun.
True or false? Walmart has eye care. True. Stop by Walmart to save and browse top designer frames right where you already shop. And they accept most insurance. Welcome to Easy Eye Care. Welcome to your Walmart.